From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, from NYPD Blue, we meet actor James McDaniel. He plays the cool and in control Lieutenant Arthur Fancy. On tonight's episode, we get a rare glimpse of Fancy's personal side when his former foster son is arrested on drug charges. We'll talk with McDaniel about his character and about how the issue of race is dealt with in the series. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Emancipation, the new CD by the artist formerly known as Prince. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The government reports the nation's trade deficit rose 19% in the third quarter of this year. The Commerce Department says the broadest measure of the deficit rose to $48 billion between July and September. That's the worst showing ever for the so-called current account. U.S. exports fell for the first time in 3 years. The current account measures sales of goods and services, as well as investment flows and foreign aid. So far this year, the current account deficit is running at an annual rate of $164 billion, way ahead of last year's total $148 billion. Paris police have arrested several suspects in connection with a subway bombing a week ago that killed 4 people and injured more than 80. David Culhane reports from Paris.
Police carried out raids on locations in Paris and the surrounding suburbs. The police action centered on areas and buildings housing mainly North African populations. The chief suspects in the bombing are Algerian terrorists, angry at France for supporting the military regime in their country. Authorities have also circulated to neighboring countries a list of people they want to interrogate. These are the first arrests in the case and may represent a breakthrough. Last year, after a bombing campaign that left 8 people dead, similar arrests were made, but no one came to trial. The latest arrests were ordered by one of the anti-terrorist magistrates charged with investigating the bombing. For National Public Radio, this is David Culhane in Paris.
Unabomber suspect Theodore Kaczynski will appear today by video conference hookup in a New Jersey courtroom. He's to be arraigned for the 1993 mail bomb slaying of advertising executive Thomas Moser. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
Theodore Kaczynski will be asked to enter a plea today. He's accused of mailing the bomb that killed Thomas Moser at his North Caldwell, New Jersey home in 1993. He won't actually be in the Newark, New Jersey courtroom. He'll appear by video teleconference from Sacramento, California, where he's jailed pending a Unabomber trial there. Defense attorneys will argue today that the New Jersey charges should be combined with the California charges into one trial in California. The prosecution wants to keep the cases separate and try Kaczynski in New Jersey first next June. Prosecutors believe Kaczynski killed 3 people and injured 23 others in a 17-year bombing spree. He's pleaded not guilty to all charges so far. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
An annual report has again ranked Los Angeles the worst city in the nation for traffic jams. The report was prepared by Texas A&M University. This is LA's 8th year as the worst city for traffic. The report ranks cities on the number of miles that drivers travel on freeways and major streets, one of the least congested urban areas in the country, Corpus Christi, Texas. On Wall Street, the Dow's up 31 points. This is NPR. Iraq's re-entry into the oil export business has stalled. President Saddam Hussein turned on the pipeline that's supposed to carry oil from Iraq to the Turkish Mediterranean coast, but no oil is flowing. A Turkish official says there's been an electrical problem in Iraq. It's not clear when the problem will be corrected. The United Nations has given Iraq permission to resume oil exports to buy food. The deal allows Iraq to export $2 billion worth of oil for 6 months for food and medicine. The United Nations Security Council opens preliminary voting on a new Secretary General today. The Council's considering 4 African candidates as alternatives to current leader Boutros Boutros-Ghali. His term ends this month. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
Boutros Ghali suspended his candidacy last week after the United States vetoed him for a second term, charging that he has obstructed reform at the UN. That leaves the Security Council clear to consider 4 new candidates, including the foreign minister of Ivory Coast and Kofi Annan of Ghana, who heads UN peacekeeping operations. Council members said there was no clear consensus candidate among the four. The council is scheduled to conduct an informal vote first to test the strength of each. If the informal voting ends in a deadlock, the Security Council might seek additional candidates, but diplomats say it is extremely unlikely that the council would reconsider Boutros Ghali, even if it deadlocks, on the alternative candidates. I'm Ann Cooper in New York.
South Africa is marking International Human Rights Day by adopting a new constitution. President Nelson Mandela signed the document today in Sharpeville. The black township was the site of one of the country's worst massacres. Police shot and killed 69 black protesters there in 1960. Today's signing of the constitution comes after more than 6 years of negotiation. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, James McDaniel, plays Lieutenant Arthur Fancy on NYPD Blue. He plays a very decent, ethical lieutenant who backs up his men when they deserve it. As an African-American, Fancy is acutely aware of racism, but does his best to keep his emotions in check. Tonight's a good night to see him in action. The episode brings back the character of Maceo Williams, a teenager who briefly became Lieutenant Fancy's foster son after Maceo's mother was sent off to a drug detox program. When she was released from the program, Fancy reluctantly complied with a court order to return Maceo to his mother. Tonight, Maceo is arrested on drug charges, and Lieutenant Fancy intervenes. Here's Lieutenant Fancy visiting Maceo in his cell.
Maceo.
It's a mistake. I don't know how that got in there. Someone must have put it there. I don't know about it.
Why would someone put heroin in your gym bag?
I know, but that's the only thing that could have happened.
You want me to believe you? Don't talk to me like a chump.
I'm just telling you what happened.
And I'm telling you, you got to do better than that.
I don't have to do anything. I mean, what are you here for anyway? I didn't ask you here. You're not my father.
No. For a couple of months, I took care of you. I'm not your father.
You got that right.
When the court gave your mother custody, Maceo, you cut us off.
You didn't want me. I didn't see a point staying in touch.
You know we fought to keep you.
I don't have to talk about this. And if you can't get me out of here, I need a lawyer.
Okay. Okay, you're 16 years old. You go with a lawyer instead of cooperating, you'll get tried as an adult. The kind of weight you were holding buys you 10 years. Were you running that smack for your mother?
No.
Are you her mule, Maceo?
I'm not talking to you anymore. I'm not talking to anybody.
The character of Maceo is played by Alex Bess, a young actor who James McDaniel has mentored for several years. In fact, Bess's role on NYPD Blue grew out of his relationship with McDaniel. This is the second time they've worked together on the series, but they've worked together outside the series, too.
It's actually about the eighth time that Alex and I have acted together. As a matter of fact, I wrote the first play that he ever did when he was, I believe, about 8 years old. We had met in a group called the 52nd Street Project, which is a mentor program where actors and directors and writers work with children. We kind of take them away. They're from the Hell's Kitchen area of New York City. And we take them away to these kind of idyllic settings, and we write plays with them and kind of make them the hero of the play. And we bring them back to New York, and it's kind of like the hottest ticket in town for a couple of days. And that's where we met. And our relationship just kind of grew.
Is it hard to figure out how close to get to a young person who you're mentoring, how much to let them into your life, how much responsibility to take for their life and for their career?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. It's always a question we ask. You know, we have this kind of arrangement because he used to live with us for a while in New York because he was living down in Coney Island, and we got him to the High School of Performing Arts, and he had a job after school. And what would happen was he'd get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, take the train, that long distance by himself into New York, go to school, then do his homework at work, and then have to take the train home at 8 o'clock at night, you know, which is quite dangerous. So he started living with us during the week, and he lived with us for quite a while. And now he has an open arrangement with us where if he wants to come out and see us, a plane ticket will be there the next day. And you start to think, you know, suppose there's some type of physical problem that he has, or suppose the plane falls down out of the air, you know. I mean, you know, what happens to my family just because I love this kid? Also, you know, do I want to see his report card physically? Or do I want to just ask him how he's doing in school and risk the chance that he might be, you know, lying to me or embellishing or something like that, you know? So you always worry about crossing that line.
Can you give me a sense of a time when it was really difficult to figure out where that line should be?
Yeah, I guess when, oh gosh, so many times. I mean, as simple as you know, him wanting a car and, you know, us realizing that because of his situation and because we're, I guess, kind of tweed suit liberals to a certain extent, you don't want to, you know, get too fully into that pattern of a relationship. With the give me relationship, because, you know, I've got kids myself and I have no problem saying no to them. But sometimes we've had problems saying no to Alex. And the most ridiculous of which was when he wanted his first car, and he sent me literature of the car that he wanted, and it was a brand new BMW. And it really made us investigate what we were doing with our relationship. Were we just giving him what he wanted because it relieved us of some type of guilt? It made us feel like we were doing the right thing with this societal position. We were giving back, you know, or were we really helping? So the arrangement is, if it has anything to do with school or his career, we'll go to the end of the earth to try and make things work for him. But if it has anything to do with material things, he ain't getting it.
Now, did you have a mentor when you were getting started in acting?
Gosh, I had so many. I kind of tripped into acting. And I tripped in. I thought it was fairly late. I was 21 years old. And I'd had no prior experience at all. And I got lucky enough to get on the stage pretty much right away and right into the thick of it, a hit off-Broadway production. And from that, I developed somewhat of a reputation, and I did play after play after play. So my mentors were all the people that I was working with at that particular point in time, and some of the people were actors we really, you know, admire and respect.
Now, how did you get the role on NYPD Blue as Lieutenant Fancy?
They just gave it to me. They told me about it about 2 years before we actually did the show, because it had a 2 year earlier start date. But Stephen was flying all over the country talking to all these censor boards trying to get the show past them.
Oh, this is Stephen Bochco.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Excuse me, name dropper. But he is my friend. And I actually know him. And he had been flying all over, and he'd give me a call from his plane and say, things are great, the show's on. And then 2 weeks later, he'd call me and say, I don't know if this is ever going to work. It's off, you know, it's off, it's on, it's on, it's off. Then finally, it actually happened. I turned down quite a few jobs on the hope that this show would actually get off the ground.
Was the character written with you in mind?
Yeah, and I could really never figure that out. Because they said, you're going to be the lieutenant of this squad of detectives. And I was saying, out of all the things that I could be doing, I see myself much more on the street running around chasing perps, you know. I'm not that old yet, you know. How am I going to live up to that? That's not the way I see myself at all, you know. I mean, when we had started talking about this, I was, you know, it was around the time I was doing 6 Degrees of Separation. I was playing a 21-year-old interloper into a family's life, you know. I was playing a kid. And they wanted me to play this leader of men, and I knew that I was going to be working with Dennis Franz, and, you know, I mean, I want to be a leader, Dennis Franz. So I had to figure out a way to make that work, and I got gradually I got used to the idea.
You had to figure out how to be a convincing authority figure.
Yeah, yeah, uh-huh.
Well, how'd you
do it? A lot of thought went in. Well, one of the things that I realized from, you know, my years of being on the stage is if you want somebody to do what you want them to do, The best way to do it is quietly. For example, if someone's making a move to the door and your next line is stop, the best way to do it is to just say stop as quietly as possible so that it's barely audible to the audience, because that actor has to stop after all, right? So if you scream, that means that you have to scream in order to make that person hear you. But if you do it very quietly, he's got to turn around. And that connotes power. And that's one of the things that I use on the show, is that he's very confident, and he makes his wishes known by just really never raising his voice. He just says what he wants done. That's one thing. And then I started to reflect on the people in my life that I knew that were authority figures, and I kind of, you know, spiced it with all those influences I've had.
Who are you thinking of, father, grandfather?
My grandfather, definitely. He was that kind of stoic kind of guy that you didn't really know who he was. But he was, I guess when I was a kid, he worked on the railroads, you know, laying tracks. He was a big guy and very, very quiet. He would sit in the chair and watch Ed Sullivan every Sunday. And all the kids knew when they were in the living room not to even cross his sight path, you know. And he would never raise his voice, but you never wanted to see him angry, because you knew that there was a volcano under there. But then he would take a pole and some wire and a woman's stockings and make butterfly nets for all the kids and take you to the park when the butterflies were all over the place. And he would just sit there, and we'd run around for hours just chasing these butterflies, and he would just talk to us. So we had this gentle side. Every night he would take all the kids, because I saw him on holidays, Christmas and things like that, and he would take all the kids one by one to the bathroom at, like, you know, 12 o'clock at night when he went to bed. You wouldn't even remember it. I have a vague recollection of it because I was always, you know, really drowsy. So he's a very loving man, but in a way he was very distant.
My guest is James McDaniel. He plays Lieutenant Arthur Fancy on NYPD Blue. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James McDaniel. He plays Lieutenant Arthur Fancy on NYPD Blue. Now, one of the things you give the impression of in NYPD Blue is of always, like, checking your emotions, reining them in. You always get the feeling that there's stuff this character is thinking that he's not showing and he's not talking about. Do you feel the same way about the character? Do you feel like that's your approach to him?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, you know, this is the cognitive thing that I actually, it doesn't just happen. I don't just show up on the set and it happens like magic, you know. It's, you know, I'm acting. The thing that you have to remember when you do something like that is, when you have a secret, you have to really have a secret. Because if you don't have a secret, the audience will know that you don't have a secret. It won't just appear that way because you just don't say anything, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, so if there's stuff that you're not revealing, you have to know what it is that you're not revealing.
Exactly.
So what are some of the things that your character knows about his real feelings that he never tells us about?
Well, one of the things with him is that he's got this black thing, and he seethes about, he's definitely a seether. And he sees a certain amount of injustice, and he's dedicated to overcoming that with every fiber of his being. And it drives him. It makes him almost sick sometimes, because he feels as if he can't be wrong. And everybody should be allowed to feel that they can be wrong sometime, just fly off the handle, say things they don't really mean. But he's so connected to that as a black man. Once he leaves his house, you know, once he puts on his suit, he becomes this other individual. And it's really interesting to me, and it's something that we really haven't gotten into, is I'd like to see him on the other side of that door much more.
At home, you mean?
At home. Just in his private life, when he can let that guard down. Because, you know, that's a part of his secret. I know what he does when he lets his guard down.
What does he do?
Oh, lets himself be crazy. He lets his anger come to the surface. He lets his humor come to the surface. They're one and the same, you know. And he's much more like me.
So you're like this too? You're somebody who has his guard up in a more public setting and then lets your guard down when you're at home?
Sometimes I'm like that. One of the first things, I mean, we can't see each other, you know.
You and I, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, because, right, I'm talking to you long distance. I'm in Philly, and you're in a studio in Los Angeles.
Right. One of the first things that, you know, interviewers say to me when they meet me is, you know, I'm nothing like the guy, you know. And especially if you were to see me at work, I am by far and away the biggest cut-up on the set. I mean, yesterday we're shooting a scene, and I had to walk into the locker room. So I walk into the locker room, and Dennis Rines and Gordon Clapp are mooning me as I walk in to begin my big scene. And then, so I laugh, everybody has a good time, walk out again, action again. Next time it's the director, and he's mooning me with his pants all the way down. And next time I come in, it's like half the crew. So we finally get ourselves together because we're wasting too much film, and I walk in, and then I moon them. You know, I mean, it just gets really, really stupid. But at the same time, people know when I'm serious, and they back off. And they knew that it was safe to do that at that time because that's the tone I set.
Now, you know how you were talking about your character as having kind of very, very deep and very strong feelings about race in America, but keeping that in check on the job, just keeping that in and just kind of steaming without revealing what he's really thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been like that yourself on the subject of race?
Oh, yeah. I mean, to a certain extent, it's one of the things that motivates me. It's been a great motivator for me. I'm very fortunate to be a black man, you know? This is going to sound awful, but it, to a certain degree, has kept James McDaniel from being mediocre. I really think it's one of the driving forces behind me to prove that that I can be good, that I can be somebody, and to make the world see, so that other people like myself can kind of feel like they're somebody. I mean, that sounds pretty pompous, I guess, but that's one of the things that drives me. You know, I see double standards all the time, and I can never really understand it. I really won't be happy until people can just walk into the room, and we live in a colorless society, and I feel like we're so, so far away from that. People just need to look at each other and talk to each other and, from making that assessment, decide whether or not they like each other, just based on what they hear, what they believe is in someone else's heart.
There was a great episode of NYPD Blue a while back in which race was one of the subjects, and Sipowicz had used a racial epithet with someone on a case that he was working after that person used that word in describing himself. So Sipowicz was accused of being a racist, but he defended himself by saying, well, he used it to describe himself first, and I was just following up on it. And then you and he have a big blow-up over this, and whether he, you know, you're accusing him of behaving poorly on the case, of being unprofessional on the case, and he's basically accusing you of playing the race card. Let me play that scene where you and he have that big encounter.
Okie doke.
Would have been smarter for you to go home when the shift ended. If you're going after me, you bring charges or let Quasi do it. Because I want a chance to answer him in front of somebody besides you.
Yeah, this is about me, Andy. I'm the racist.
I've said that word.
I've thought it plenty, but I've never used it on a job till your hump pal put us on that road.
This isn't about a word, Andy, or your impure thoughts. It's about you making this case harder to work.
Not about you being black, huh? Not about giving some back to me?
It's about what I say it's about.
Then say, part of what it's about is watching me sweat.
Well, a hell of a lot went down today, so I'd have to check my notes. But I thought I'd spend some of that time trying to save your sorry ass.
Give me a break.
No, I'm not going to take you out, Andy. I move you out, my white bosses, they send me a little message. They send me another one just like you. But maybe that one can't do the job like you can.
Jeez, thanks a lot, boss.
If you go, it'll be somebody like Quasi, or like that reporter. I've been dealing with white cops like you ever since the academy. I can manage you with my eyes closed. Now maybe you can't handle a black man being your boss.
I can handle it. I've been covering you 3.5 years, except when you get so tied up in your brother crap, you won't let us work the streets. That's when you get yourself in trouble.
Hey, Lou, we got a report of a person shot near the Houseman Street Projects. Want me to handle it?
Was it a homicide?
I don't know.
That teenage girl, the eyewitness, isn't she in those projects?
Yeah, I think we got him out, though.
Sylvie was involved there.
Check it out.
You want me to check it out?
Yeah. Sipwitz will handle it.
Did this scene and the whole episode lead to discussions about race off camera?
Well, I mean, we discuss race a lot anyway, you know, or we kind of used to, you know, especially me and Dennis, you know, because we come from two very different backgrounds. So, you know, we talk about race. It's a part of our dialogue. I mean, we spend a lot of time together, you know, off the set, you know, we're in the makeup trailer, you know, we're sitting there having lunch sometimes. We're in between shots. You know, it's not the time that it takes to take a take. It's the time between the takes that takes the time. So we're sitting together for a long time. And race comes into dialogue a lot.
What kind of things do you talk about?
Well, I mean, for example, one of the conversations that Dennis and I had that was so memorable was him saying, what happened with, you know, like kids, you know, especially inner city kids and things like that. And cops, you know, what happened to Officer Friendly? You know, he couldn't understand why, you know, somebody would want to throw a brick at a squad car because they are there to protect us, to serve and protect. And I'm trying to tell him that, you know, maybe that's the way it was where he came from. But a lot of people don't feel that way. A lot of people feel that, they maybe are there to serve and oppress, maybe. And it's just a different point of view. And we go back and forth about that, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. You know, one bad apple, you know, argument.
James McDaniel, he plays Lieutenant Arthur Fancy on NYPD Blue. We'll talk more in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux, publishers of The Christmas Mystery, a holiday tale by Yostein Garter, author of Sophie's World. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, racial issues on and off camera. We continue our conversation with actor James McDaniel, who plays Lieutenant Arthur Fancy on NYPD Blue. Also, a review of Emancipation, the new CD by the artist formerly known as Prince. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with James McDaniel, who plays Lieutenant Arthur Fancy on NYPD Blue. When we left off, we were talking about an episode in which Lieutenant Fancy confronts Detective Sipowicz, played by Dennis Franz, about his attitude, and Sipowicz accuses Fancy of playing the race card. I asked McDaniel about an earlier episode in which Fancy took Sipowicz to an African-American restaurant to give Sipowicz a sense of what it's like to be the outsider and feel set apart, even if no one is displaying overt hostility.
People talk about that scene, and that was a while ago.
Yeah.
That was the first season.
Mm-hmm.
People still, it's certain scenes ring true, I guess. And the funny thing is, when we saw it on the page, we talked about that scene for a week and a half before we actually did it. Because it was so obscure. It took such a long time before you realized what was actually going on in that scene. The nickel didn't drop until the very, very end of the scene. And we were starting to wonder if anybody would know what we're talking about. Because it's written down on a piece of paper. You don't know how it's going to come out. And we're very confused about it. And finally, we just went for it. And it's a scene that to this day, people always remind me about.
Did you like the way it came out, or did you have problems with it and want to change it?
I wanted to add a couple of things.
What did you want to add?
And did. You just mentioned things like we're in a rib joint, basically. And Sipowicz is saying to me, why'd you bring me here? What are you doing? You're squeezing my shoes. And I'm saying, relax, just eat the food. It's good, I like it. I eat it. And I was saying to them that I wouldn't eat this kind of food all the time,
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I wouldn't live on this, Come on, I'm a man of the 90s, I mean, this big, greasy pork thing. And I had to express to them that, we don't, sit down at a rib joint three times a week, And it's just a flavor, just a little color to add some authenticity for everybody that would understand that situation. And I think that's why people like that scene so much, because everybody could relate to it. And it didn't pander to the audience, The audience had to actually keep up with that scene. And we gave them credit for being as smart as they are. And I think it rang true to a lot of people.
How did you prepare for the role of Lieutenant Fancy when the series was starting? Did you hang out with cops?
Yeah, that's the first thing. Yeah, and that was really interesting, too, when you're trying to fashion a character. Because the first thing you want to do, and hence the term role models, you want to see the closest person that you could be to that guy. And, Bill Clark, our technical advisor then, who is now one of our supervising producers, was hooking me up with a lot of people who did my job. And the guys were like, hey, Joey, could you run down and give me a cup of coffee? They were all those kind of bent nose kind of guys. And I could relate to them to a certain degree. But I just couldn't get that thing. I couldn't see me being them,
Mm-hmm.
Most of them were like father figures and stuff, And I couldn't see me in that role. But I met this one black lieutenant named Gene Albright, who is much older than me. But he helped me out a lot, because what it made me realize is what Arthur Fancy could be. That there wasn't like a strict stereotype or a mold that I had to come out of, because this guy had an art degree and he was very literate and he was very different. Had a very, very high kind of nasal voice. He didn't strike me as being extraordinarily manly. And what that does when you see that is it releases you to other possibilities that maybe your imagination hadn't allowed you to accept.
Right. So you didn't have to be the streetwise guy from the neighborhood. You could be an educated, middle class,
intellectual.
Yeah. Not particularly like physical, the kind of guy who's really going to throw his weight around.
Right. And not to say that that's what I knew I had to be.
Mm-hmm.
It made me realize that to occupy that job, you did not have to be one thing. Like, you know,
why
is it when you see an airline pilot, right, and then you see the navigational guy, and then you see the co-pilot, and they're all walking down the hallway, you know, to the airplane,
mm-hmm.
you always know which one's the pilot, right?
That's true.
You always know which one's the pilot. So that's one of the things that you probably got to be in most cases to be the pilot.
Before you became Lieutenant Fancy on NYPD Blue, you were starring on Broadway in Six Degrees of Separation.
Yeah.
In which you basically played a street kid who impersonates being the son of Sidney Poitier and fools all these upper and upper middle class people into thinking that he's the sophisticated son of a celebrity, you know, highly, you know, very well bred and used to money and all the comforts and everything, when really he's not at all. And so he has to play two really different kinds of parts in a way, the streetwise kid and the very educated upper class kid. What was that like for you?
It was a match made in heaven. I set my sights on that role. I auditioned for that role for 6 months.
Mm.
Yeah, and my
That's
auditions
a long were, audition.
Yeah, yeah, and my auditions were like, you know, an hour and a half long. We go through the whole entire play. Jerry Zaks, the director, he was such a nut about this. But that's the way he does it, you know. And I just knew I knew both sides of that guy, you know, because I've lived both. You know, that's kind of what I bring to this whole party here. That's what I'm selling. Everybody's selling something, you know. And what I'm selling is that I know both sides of that, like the back of my hands. I've lived on both sides of that. And to the extent that I don't have to dress up to look like a preppy.
Mm-hmm.
I could look like anybody and sit on their couch with my feet folded and my shoes on, you know, which would be apparently a disrespectful act. But it's like past that, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I know those people. And then what he was in his former life or what he was trying to escape from, I know those people too.
How do you know that?
Well, you know, I spent a fair amount of time, you know, running around the streets. I come from Washington, D.C. That's what I'm from. That's where I'm from. When I was a kid, my dad was going to college on the GI Bill. My mother was a kind of, you know, provisionary head of the household, you know, financially anyway. And, you know, we're having a rough time. You know, I didn't really know it, but, my mom would call me at the door and tell me to come in because some jerk was shooting out on the streets, you know. I know that.
So you have two different sides to draw on for roles, which is good. Now, I know your father is a doctor, yes?
Yep.
Did he take care of you when you were sick, when you were growing up? I was afraid of my doctor. I think most kids are afraid of the doctor because the doctor might give them a shot.
No, we had this thing that, we went to the doctors all the time because it was professional courtesy. So he would just call Joe, and Joe would say, come on in, and in turn, Joe would do that to him, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if we had the sniffles, we went to the doctor, but no, he didn't. He didn't. You know, he was an OBGYN. He is still practicing in OBGYN, and no, he didn't deliver me.
Right, right.
That would be kind of unprofessional.
James McDaniel is my guest, and he plays Lieutenant Fancy on NYPD Blue. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James McDaniel. He plays Lieutenant Arthur Fancy on NYPD Blue. After having played a cop yourself for several years, what do you think of cops now, and particular, you know,
police relations in Los Angeles are so racially charged now, and have been for many years. Do you find yourself relating to the cops or what?
No, I keep it simple. I relate to people. You know, there's good cops and there's bad cops.
Right.
And, you know, bad cops make bad policy and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get just as exasperated by cops now as I ever did. You know, I mean, you know, I drive an expensive car. It's not unusual for me to be pulled over twice on the way home on any given evening, you know, because my windows are slightly tinted. I mean, we know what that's about. So I just take it kind of a person at a time, you know, knowing that it's human nature. There's some good guys and there's some bad guys. There's a real problem out in L.A., I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, when you're pulled over by a cop, I guess you're assuming it's because you're an African-American driving an expensive car. They think that there's something suspicious happening, is that?
Well, it's not specifically that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's... As a cop, you are trained that you're supposed to spot things that are out of the ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
Or that's what you think you're being trained to do. And in any individual's mind, it may be out of the ordinary that this guy is driving this car. Let's check this out.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's not necessarily a racial thing, but there are racial overtones within that observation.
Now, when that happens to you and you're pulled over, do you ever make a point of making sure that the cop knows who you are, what your role is, how paradoxical this whole situation is?
I don't lean on the show. Because
right.
That's just...
Do you know
means,
who
that,
I
that
am?
Gives me, yeah, yeah. You know, when those words come out of my mouth,
uh-huh.
That's going to be a big day.
Right.
That's really... I'm going to say, uh-oh, Jim, you've gone over to the other side. Things have gotten really bad. You are officially an L.A. jerk. But I do try to make some type of statement
like?
About it. But it, just what we said, you know, I'll make a big deal as to why the stop. You know, the first thing I do is I make sure that my automobile, everything checks out, even though my windows are slightly tinted. But, I mean, everybody's windows are tinted in L.A. You know, you can't drive a car that doesn't have tinted windows. Your upholstery gets ruined, and you're hot all the time, you know. So I got the lightest tint possible. But everything else on my car checks out, and it's like right there, bam, open the glove compartment, boom, it's there. And from that point on, I just start talking to him. I start asking him why he's doing this, and I try to get into his psychology so that when we finally separate, he thinks about it a little bit. It was kind of an unusual experience.
What kind of reactions have you gotten after talking with the cops who pull you over?
Well, L.A. cops are tough because they have this veneer that's very unlike New York cops, whereby they try to act like perfect human beings. Hello, sir. How are you? You know, we're just about to shoot you, but have a nice day. You know, they go through some type of training for that. I don't know what it is. You know, it's like smile and hate you at the same time, you know. New York cop, if they don't like you, you know, they make no bones about it. It's like, I don't like you, buddy, right now, right here. Let's go. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. No, is there anything you've been able to use on NYPD Blue from your experiences, from your encounters with cops who've pulled you over?
Well, you know, if I was a street cop, there definitely would be. My approach would be to play one of those guys because, you know, that goes straight across race lines, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because I've had that experience. That's why I say it's not necessarily a racial thing, because I've had that experience with black cops, too.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that hail fellow well met type behavior just as good as anybody else. So, if I was a street cop, I would probably play one of those guys. You know, I don't like just, you know, regular old heroes, you know, just, you know, Dudley Do Right, here he comes. I would play one of those kind of guys. Try to find the humanity in there someplace.
Now, tell me a little bit about your voice. Have you studied voice at all?
Well, you know, the funny thing about the voice is that you can do anything you want with your voice. Anything you want with your voice, if you obsess on it for just a small period of time. You can change it. You can manipulate it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the way you walk. You can walk any way you want to walk. You can walk like a prince or you can walk like a bum.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to do is think about it for a few minutes or a few days and decide how you want to walk. And then you make that a pattern for your life because you've obsessed on it for a while. And, you know, when I first got in the theater, I had to decide how I was going to talk. And my voice was not right for this industry at all when I started. It was wrong. And it might have been right for somebody else, but it wasn't right for me. And I changed it.
What was it like before?
And I still change it. I mean, you know, to a certain extent, Six Degrees was a show of voices for me.
Could you maybe do a couple of voices you had to do in that show?
Okay, well, there was a kid. I mean, I can't remember any of the dialogue, so... A substitute teacher was dropped from his job for fighting with a student. A few weeks later, the teacher returned to the classroom, shot the student unsuccessfully, held the class hostage, then shot himself successfully. This fact caught my eye. Last sentence, times. That was a kid. The real guy, okay? The guy that had come off the corner was like, I think it must be... very interesting to be with rich people. You have to know how to give them presents. It was just, you know, and my voice is like somewhere in there someplace.
Right. You said that when you started acting, you felt your voice was wrong for the industry. In what respect?
Oh, God. One of the things about this industry is you have to... It does you no good. I mean, just to use the voice analogy, suppose you're a very, very beautiful blonde woman with blue eyes, you know, and all the accoutrements that everybody loves, right? You're, you know, Pamela Jane Doe. And your voice is up here. You ain't gonna work.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, if you have that same voice... and you change the exterior and you kind of, your nose is kind of like that and your mouth is kind of like that and you're kind of funny looking, then that voice goes with that person. That person makes $1 million. The other person makes zero.
Mm-hmm.
Consistency is a pretty good thing to have in this business, okay? And I was inconsistent.
And how?
My voice was too light and breathy. My voice was similar to like a Michael Jackson.
Huh.
Yeah.
So how'd you work on it?
I would not cut it. It was easy. I just, you know, I just changed it. I became aware of it because, I mean, the first time I stepped out onto a stage or in acting class, you know, I was aware of it. And then the next time I stepped out there, it was different. I just changed it.
James McDaniel, a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
It really was. I enjoyed that.
James McDaniel plays Lieutenant Fancy on NYPD Blue. On tonight's episode, Lieutenant Fancy's former foster son is arrested on drug charges. Coming up, a new CD by the artist formerly known as Prince. This is Fresh Air. The artist formerly known as Prince has just put out a 36-song, 3-CD collection called Emancipation. It's Prince's first set of new music since he, as he's put it, was freed from the slavery of Warner Brothers Records, his label for over two decades. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
First of all, I'm just going to call him Prince, okay? That artist formerly stuff is just too awkward, and that silly-looking glyph he makes print journalists use doesn't have a verbal equivalent. Really, Prince tries a fan's patience more than any other rock star I can think of. He's coy, pretentious, silly, and prolific in a way that's more exhausting than admirable. But the fact that the guy is also the most gifted multi-instrumentalist since Stevie Wonder makes a lot of the effort worth it. On this sprawling collection, Prince is at his best when he cooks up a catchy little riff like the one that organizes this song, In This Bed I Scream. Crisp new song on Emancipation, it seems like there are two other stale, heard-it-all-before tunes. This material really could have been winnowed down to one terrific hour-long CD. But I also doubt that Prince would pick the same good ones that I would. I, for example, wouldn't have bothered with the covers he's included here, such as a tepid version of Joan Osborne's One of Us, the Stylistic's Betcha by Golly Wow, and the Bonnie Raitt hit I Can't Make You Love Me. I do like his version of the Delphonics' La La Means I Love You, even if it's virtually a squeal-for-squeal reproduction of the 1968 original.
Many guys have come to you with a line that wasn't true.
Prince's most disarming qualities is the way he can take an unpromising idea and turn it into a surprisingly juicy piece of music. Who'd have thought his computer could inspire this awfully nice little song?
It was Sunday night. Instead of doing what I usually do, I scanned my computer looking for a site. Nothing on TV I ain't seen before.
Another murder on the news. I can't take no more. Evil Incorporated, blowing up bombs and things. I have a child, I have a lot to explain. I could write a letter, but who would I send it to? It was Sunday night, instead of doing what I usually do, I scanned my computer, looking for a sight. Somebody to talk to, funny and bright. I scanned my computer, looking for a sight. Make believe it's a better world.
I think that at this point in his career, Prince's biggest problem isn't his music, but his image. His tortured weirdo pose is one that lots of people, young and old, are just tired of. It's great that on Emancipation he sounds invigorated and friendly, but this collection proves decisively that what old What's-His-Name needs most is the rock music equivalent of a good editor.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Roberta Shirock directs the show. I'm Tariq Rose.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.